Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult-use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins with the American Cannabis Conversation. Quick news. Boulder, Colorado, twins study debunks 2012 research on the impact of cannabis on the brain and IQ. A recent 2019 twins study is questioning the methodology that led to a 2012 results, suggesting that we have been making unfounded assumptions about cannabis' role in IQ drop. The study suggests that cannabis use does not cause cognitive decline at all. Instead, they found that the genetic and environmental factors can lead to both a lowered IQ scores and an increased likelihood to use cannabis. The question becomes is how did these two studies produce such different results? It primarily has to do with the different methodologies used in studying the question. Dr. Megan Ross, PhD at the University of Colorado at Boulder, says that identical twins share 100% of their genetic and shared environmental factors. She went on to say they grew up in the same household. Thus, by comparing twins, it allows us to control for genetics and numerous environmental factors. Springfield, Illinois. Illinois has become the 11th state for legalized adult use of marijuana. The market opened this past week on January 1st, experienced long lines and some supply shortages. One business, for example, had rented a nearby coffee shop to keep people warm and fed, while another has arranged for local food trucks and heat lamps. Marijuana Business Daily projects that Illinois' recreational program should generate about $2.5 billion a year, depending on in part how many tourists buy the cannabis products. The House in Washington, D.C. House Democrats failed to get a number of marijuana-related provisions attached to the large-scale spending legislation after negotiations with the Senate. Reform advocates hoped that the Republican-controlled Senate would agree to adopt measures from the House-passed version of an appropriations bill that provided protections for all state and tribal cannabis programs against federal interference. But negotiators simply agreed to keep the rider protecting just the medical cannabis markets that's been approved every year since 2014. The fiscal year 2020 spending legislation voted on by both chambers was sent to the president ahead of the Friday deadline to avoid a government shutdown. It also cut the proposal to shield banks that service marijuana market from being penalized by federal regulators, which was included in the House bill, but not the Senate's. The chairman of the Senate Banking Committee has real concerns about the SAFE bill passed by the House because of the lack of limitations on THC. This problem is going to be around for a while. And that's your America's Cannabis Conversation. Quick news. I'm Dan Perkins. On the show today, we start off with James Lee, who tells us how the industry is doubling every 2.5 years. Jim tells us some of his investment ideas for continued growth in 2020. Next is our cannabis doctor on call, Dr. Jordan Tischler, who will talk to us about another problem that people are experiencing in significant quantities, and that's sleep deprivation or sleep apnea. Next, we will hear from our cannabis serial entrepreneur, Ella Smith, who will take us on a journey on how to start a medical marijuana dispensary based on his own actual experience. Last is Emily Flippin from Motley Fool, and she's going to talk to you about picking stocks, what percentage of your portfolio might be advisable to invest in cannabis, and what kind of companies that she's looking at.
Welcome to the conversation, and joining us today is a gentleman we had on previously, Jim Lee, who was talking about idea and thoughts as a futurist about the cannabis. And I've invited him back to talk about that, but I also talk about continuing the conversation we had on the last show about specific recommendations and why he likes them. Just take a little bit of time, Jim, and go into your crystal ball. And what do you see happening over the next 5 to 10 years in the cannabis market?
I frankly see that it's a huge opportunity that's largely propelled by demographics and social change. I've been investing in marijuana stocks off and on since 2016. And what's really interesting when I talk about medical marijuana to clients, I was expecting a lot of pushback from people. What I found is that my clients who are baby boomers over the age of 60 really welcomed the idea of investing in pot stocks. And I was kind of surprised. I had relatively little resistance to it. But I still ask people if they're comfortable with it before I add it to their portfolios, because there is some, you know, lingering controversy and it's still risky. But now that you have this generation that kind of came of age in the 1960s going into positions of power, I see a big move towards the legalization of marijuana, not only in the U.S., but overseas. And I think I read research suggesting that 60% of all Americans were comfortable with marijuana legalization at some level. And there's a lot of legislation that's been going through the House and through the Senate that I think is going to help that along. Some areas are further ahead than others. I mean, right now it's being decided on a state-by-state basis, but at some point it could go national. If you look at the statistics right now, I mean, the marijuana business is growing in the U.S. 35% per year and is projected to do so for the next 5 years. And that suggests that at this speed, the industry is doubling every 2.5 years. So that's a fairly sizable opportunity.
Well, you know, it's interesting here in Florida, we have medical marijuana only, and I had an opportunity several months ago to meet the CFO of a doctor's practice. In Florida, you have to get a physician's prescription, and then you have to get a license to be able to buy it, and you get that through the doctor. And so I talked to the CFO, and I said, when you started this business, what did you think your average age of your customer would be? He said, our business plan called for 21 to 35. So I said, what's happened? He said, we were way off. We were way off. I said, what do you mean? He says, our average age is about 56 years of age. I said, 56. Yeah. And I said, where did you make your mistake thinking 21 to 35? And he said, the mistake was that we underestimated the anger, frustration, and disappointment of people over 55 with the medications primarily for one specific area, and that's pain, that they were not being satisfied with, one, the products they were taking, the side effects of taking them, and the cost. And so this gravitation to marijuana as a pain reliever is driving a huge percentage of the market. And as I've talked to people all over the country, pain management seems to be the number one issue, and the elderly deals with pain much more so than the 20 to 35-year-old market. So
it's a big opportunity, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When the baby boomers continue to expand in retirement, that market could be one of the fastest-growing markets in the country for cannabis products.
I totally agree. I think it's really fascinating, because if you look at it as a healthcare product, that's mm-hmm. the population that has the most needs for pharmaceuticals and for healthcare. So it makes
right.
total sense.
It's interesting, though. I wonder how this is going to, and I wonder if your crystal ball has any thoughts on this. The pharmaceutical industry has basically been prohibited from doing any substantive research with cannabis because it was a controlled substance.
Correct.
The DEA, however, is sponsoring an increasing amount of research. And We have a doctor who is a researcher at Harvard who's been on our show, who is working on a protocol to treat pancreatic cancer with cannabis. And his feeling is that based on the initial results that it will be successful. But he said part of our desire was to come up with a cancer treatment that everybody could afford. And because some of these cancer drugs are enormously expensive, and pure cannabis as a medication to deal with cancer is very cost very cost efficient. Question becomes, how do the pharmaceutical companies begin to react to as more and more research shows the curative and treatment power of all natural cannabis?
You're right. There are a lot of applications there in terms of cancer, in terms of pain management, in terms of post-traumatic stress disorders, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that the legislation that's in place is not supportive of research and of learning anything and knowing any better. Now, my wife's a physician, and some of her concerns are that use of cannabis may have interactions with other drugs, changing, for example, the rate at which other drugs are metabolized or taken in by the body.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have the research platform for understanding that either. So you have a lot of people taking CBD products right now. There's a big trend on that. We don't know what the side effects are, and unfortunately, we have no way of knowing that in a completely controlled environment, just because we're not allowed to do that research at this point. So it's a real issue.
Yeah, I agree. We're speaking with Jim Lee, a registered investment advisor whose specialty is investing in cannabis, and he's a futurist. In the few minutes we have left, let's talk about what you like longer term in the kind of stocks do you like in the cannabis business.
There are two or three that I like, and as a disclosure, I hold in my personal portfolio at this point. The first is one that I've been in and out of over the last few years, which is Aphria, which is a large, low-cost Canadian grower that's just been exploding in terms of their volume of production. It's one of the few growers that's profitable. So they have a PE multiple that you can evaluate. They're reasonable in terms of most of the traditional financial metrics, whether you're looking at price to book or price to sales. That's Aphria, right? And
what's the symbol for that, Jim?
That's APHA, Aphria stock. And
Where do they buy it? Where would our listeners buy it?
Yeah, shares are right under $5 at this point. Like a lot of other stocks, they had a serious sell-off a few weeks ago regarding with some of the vaping issues that really hit the sector hard. So if you look at them based on, 2021 earnings, 2020 earnings, they're trading at 30 times consensus earnings for 2020 and 16 times consensus for 2021. Which, given their growth, I think looks pretty good, and I'm comfortable with them right now. Okay. The other one that I like at this point is Trueleaf Cannabis, TCNNF. They own a large integrated distribution company, primarily in Florida at this point, trading about 16.5 times forward earnings, great momentum, $500 million market cap. It's a U.S. stock. At this point, they're one of the best performing stocks in the sector. So that's more of a short-term trade. From what I can tell, I think Aphria is more of a long-term hold.
And the last one, what is the symbol on that one?
That one is TCNNF. It's a pink sheet stock.
Okay. So how do you feel about ETFs?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because there is a big shift towards ETF investing in general. But I'm not recommending cannabis ETFs to my clients, because I really feel that there is such a huge range of opportunities And there's such a huge range of valuations in the industry that there are going to be some winners, there's going to be some losers, there's going to be consolidation. I think this is really a stock picker's market for pot stocks. I don't believe it's a good candidate for indexing.
So the two stocks that you've mentioned in the show, what percentage would you think a person might have for diversification purposes in their portfolio in cannabis-related industry?
Great question. I'm so glad that you asked that. Like a lot of other things, it's very high risk. Okay, so I think that there are really two different types of investors that are looking at cannabis investing. The first would be an investor who's relatively new to the markets, has some positive cash flow to put aside each month, but doesn't necessarily have a significant portfolio. For those investors who are just getting started out, maybe 1 or 2 months worth of savings, right? Whatever you can put aside on a monthly basis, maybe 1 or 2 months, it might be $200 or $400. I mean, the number is going to vary. But that would be a reasonable position size for someone who's just starting, doesn't have credit card debt, has positive cash flow, but doesn't have a significant portfolio. The other group does have experience. They have accumulated assets, and they can have a diversified portfolio. So for that group, I would consider, you know, a position in medical marijuana stocks somewhere between the 1 to 4% range of the total portfolio. And that's just a matter of risk management, okay?
Right.
Aggressive investors might be comfortable with a little bit more than that. But from a risk perspective, if you look at it, okay, the market at one point was down 60% for pot stocks. If you had a 5% position in pot stocks, you would have knocked off 3 percentage points of return on your whole portfolio as a result of those, right?
Right.
So
you
can't always control your returns, but you can control your risk exposures, and that's why position sizing is so important.
That's great advice. We have been talking with Jim Lee, a visionary and an investor for a long time in marijuana and cannabis stocks. And Jim, thank you for joining us today. And how can people follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter at J-H-L-I-N-D-E. My website's www.stratfi.com. And my email is jlee, that's J-L-E-E, at stratfi, stratfi.com.
Thank you, Jim, for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
This is Dan Perkins, host of America's Cannabis Conversation, and I want to hear from you. Send me an email. Tell me what you like about our show, what you don't like about our show, what kind of guests you'd like to hear from, and are there subjects that are important to you that we're not discussing? Let us know. Go to W420RadioNetwork.com and send us an email. Thanks for listening.
Well, welcome back to the conversation, and we're talking today again to our cannabis doctor on call, Dr. Jordan Tischler. And what we want to do is continue the last conversation we had when we were talking about sleep deprivation and insomnia and other things. And Dr. Tischler finished the conversation about people looking for alternatives to prescription drugs. Doctor, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's always my pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So when we finished the last show, Doctor, you talked about people seeking out alternatives to prescription drugs. Why and what are they looking at?
Well, the first thing I would say is, you know, given my background as a physician, I don't necessarily shy away from pharmaceuticals, nor do I necessarily recommend shying away from them in certain circumstances. When we're talking about insomnia, there are a number of medications out there that can be helpful, from things like trazodone or Ambien. And there are a bunch of others. And frankly, good old over-the-counter Benadryl in the right person can be very helpful. Not so much in the elderly where it can cause some other side effects. But really, side effects to those medications is the thing that kind of pushes us to think about those alternatives that you've mentioned. And there are a lot of them out there at this point. The question is really how well do they work and are they safe and reliable? So, you know, before we get into the obvious conversation about cannabis, we need to mention that there are people who have been taking things like melatonin and even people who are taking valerian root. And for some people, this seems to help. The medical literature on the use of those two substances is less convincing than most people who use them would attest. And I that's fine. That is to say, if people are using these stuff and we think they're safe and they're getting benefit, then I'm not really going to argue with it. I think the real question becomes when somebody uses them and they don't get benefit, then what's next? And that really brings us into that discussion around cannabis. Cannabis, I think, probably the thing it does best of all, and it does many things pretty well, is to treat insomnia. And the key to getting it to work properly, as we kind of talked about last time, is to figure out what sort of insomnia we're talking about, because the dosing and even more importantly, the form of delivery of the cannabis is influenced by what sort of insomnia. So, you know, we talked last time a little bit about people having insomnia that falls into the category of difficulty getting to sleep, difficulty staying asleep, and then sort of this mixed category of both. And so when we think about people who are having trouble getting to sleep, what we really want is something that relatively rapidly works to make people drowsy and not just drowsy, but also sort of relax the anxiety, the rumination, the intrusive thoughts, and then allows them to kind of naturally drift off to sleep. And cannabis is good at that. But in those circumstances, my recommendation would be to use the cannabis by inhalation. And as we talked about before, inhalation in my world means not smoking and not using those oil pens, because neither of those are good for us in the long-term sense, but rather using a flower or botanical vaporizer, which is a machine into which we put the ground botanical material, the stuff we used to call weed, and that is a device that can extract the medicine for us in a safe manner. And so a couple of puffs or so on that sort of a device, 15, 20 minutes before we want to go to sleep. And that's kind of the recipe right there. And what we expect at that low dose is not some overwhelming, experience, but rather just kind of a gentle relaxation of both body and mind that then allows us to drift off to sleep.
I obviously am not a doctor. As I mentioned to you before, I do have had a sleep issue. And I was, and I'm perfectly willing to say this on the air, I was somewhat reluctant to go through the process of using cannabis with THC. So as an alternative, I decided I was going to do some research on CBD. And my dear wife, only accidentally, because we're in our 70s, we're concerned about exercise and fitness. And she got me for my birthday, and she bought one for herself too, a Fitbit Charge 3. And what that device does is one of the things it does, it checks it your sleep pattern and gives you a sleep score. And it breaks down light sleep, REM sleep, and then deep sleep and waking time. And when I first got the Fitbit and was doing it, I probably got somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes of REM level sleep on a typical night, some nights less, some nights more. Many incidents of being awake, but not as much as somebody who has COPD. So I decided, I started experimenting with the gummies, not smoking or inhaling, but just using the gummies. And what I found, doctor, is that not only do my knees no longer hurt, but I'm now getting between 60 and 90 minutes of REM sleep a night fairly regularly. I get more deep sleep. So I feel more refreshed, if that's the right word, even just using CBD. I can't imagine what it must be like with cannabis, but I've chosen to go a different route. And yet I'm not going to the narcotic substance, because I had too much experience working with veterans about being knocked out, and being knocked out by an opioid is not going to give me a chance to rest and heal. So is there a particular strain of cannabis that you like to use, or how do you decide which is the right one for your patients?
That's an interesting question. The answer to which is I don't recommend specific strains for two reasons. One is, if I were to, then it would be extraordinarily unlikely that any of my patients would ever find what it was I recommended. And worse yet, then as soon as they had used up the first batch and went back to the store, they wouldn't find what I had recommended a second time. So I tend to recommend things kind of more by a set of parameters. Okay. That way they can match what's in stock to what it is that I'm recommending. But when it really comes down to strains, I am pretty unimpressed. I think people generate some preferences here and there. But most people, when given this stuff in sort of a blinded fashion, really can't tell the difference, and it doesn't really matter. I think that there's a lot of discussion about strains that is sort of left over from, the sort of drug culture and frankly, marketing, right? I mean, mm-hmm. how much can you sell of weed if the bottom line is, yeah, my weed is just as good as anybody else's weed. But I'm telling you as a physician that as long as it's safe, that's really pretty much what we can say about it. I tend to recommend some medium potency, not the high potency stuff. And that has a lot of sort of technical reasons having to do with allowing for some of these helper chemicals to come along with the THC. But at the end of the day, when people say, what do you think of strains? I say, yeah, I think they're mostly marketing. There's no question that at some point down the line, we may be able to make actual pharmaceuticals that are more dependent on which chemicals are in different strains. But right now, when you're going to the store and you're buying either the flower of the plant or some product like a gummy that's been manufactured from those flowers, I'm underwhelmed by the importance of that sort of thing. I think the dose is far more important. And so when we were talking just a moment ago about inhalation, and I said a couple of puffs, I really kind of meant that, actually, that, you know, if you sit there with a vaporizer, if you take, you know, a bunch of puffs, then you're going to end up with more than you need, and then you're going to get side effects from that you don't really want, which may be anxiety or paranoia, those sorts of things. And it will maybe even as simple as just more racing mind, and that's going to interfere with the getting to sleep that we're trying to accomplish.
But you can't relax.
Well, exactly. And so, you know, at some point, at some dose, cannabis can actually produce some minor hallucinations, which, for recreational users is generally a positive. That's the kind of thing they're looking for. But, you know, in this context for this use, that's not really where we want to go, because it just becomes counterproductive. It may be enjoyable, but at 3 a.m, we don't want to be enjoying. We want to be sleeping. So that's, you mentioned gummies, right? And that's where I would look at that sort of thing. And the reason, again, is that while the inhalation has rapid onset, it also has a relatively short duration of about 3 or 4 hours. So if your problem is that you wake up at 3 a.m, then inhaling something at 10:30 at night isn't really going to last you through the evening. And so with the gummies, they have a longer onset, so they're not great for getting to sleep, but they're really good for keeping us asleep because they have that prolonged duration. And again, low dose, we're talking about, 5 to 10 milligrams kind of type of thing typically holds people through the night.
And when you, in the few seconds we have left, when you start taking 5, 10 milligrams, does the body become resistant to it so that over time you have to increase it, or does that not happen?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is not if we stick to this low dose, but if we start to be incautious about it and we start to accelerate that dose or increase that dose, then it can become kind of like the proverbial snowball rolling downhill. So if we use a little more, then we develop that resistance, then we use a little more, we develop more resistance, et cetera. And this is how we see some of our more recreationally oriented friends end up being, you know, using a whole lot of this stuff.
Right.
It's not that hard for us to wean people down into a more stable range, but really at that sort of 5 to 10 milligram range, what we find is that there is no significant need to accelerate the dose over time.
Terrific. We've been speaking with the cannabis doctor on call, Dr. Jordan Tischler. Doctor, how do people get a hold of you?
My website, which is inhalemd.com. Again, inhalemd.com. We've got hundreds of articles on subjects just like this, and you can reach out to us through the website and we'll get right back to you. We do online consultations and all those sorts of things so that people can get the help that they need.
Thank you for joining us on the conversation today, Doctor, and we'll look forward to having you on again in the near future.
Sounds awesome.
And for those of you that didn't get a chance to hear all of this interview, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com and you can listen to the archive section, other shows, including other shows with our cannabis doctor on call. We'll be right back.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
This is Dan Perkins, and we're about halfway through today's conversation. I hope you have found the people interesting and helpful. In case you didn't hear all of the interviews in today's conversation, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com after 5:20 p.m. to listen to this show. If you missed any of our previous shows, or you want to hear a particular show again, you can go to the archives and download a missed show anytime that's convenient for you. Our goal is to bring a high-quality program that is both entertaining and informative. For those of you who are in the industry, we hope we can continue to be your voice, telling the people of America the benefits of this amazing all-natural product. We have been surprised at the willingness of important people to come into this new program and talk about the challenges and opportunities in the cannabis industry. It's hard to believe that it's been 23 years since cannabis was made legal in California. I think the next 23 years might be even more exciting than the first 23. One more thing before we get back to the conversation. Should you have a question or a comment, please contact us at contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. That's contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. And now, back to the conversation.
Joining us in the conversation today is Ellis Smith. He's been on our program before, and I've asked him back because one of the things that I have found as I've talked to people all over the country, there's a lot of people interested in getting in the cannabis business, but they don't have any idea what it means to get in. And I've asked him to help us explain to our audience what it means to get into the cannabis retail space. So, Ellis, thank you for coming back and joining us today.
Dan, thanks for having me again. I'm excited to be on.
Thank you. I've talked to a lot of millennials who want to get involved in the cannabis business because they want to get rich. And I suppose that's okay, but they have no clue. They have no clue what it means to open up a dispensary. So take a few minutes and tell our audience, as somebody who's built dispensaries all over the country, what's involved in starting a cannabis dispensary?
I'd be glad to. So getting into the retail space of the cannabis industry, it's very sexy. It's a lot of fun. You get to be front and center on hopefully Main Street or somewhere where the public can see that you are one of the first to sell this plant. So it's very exciting to want to get into this side of the industry. And there's great margins that you can make doing this business. But before you can think about making all those margins, there's a lot of things to put in place so that you can execute operationally and be successful at this business. And so first and foremost, I would encourage our listeners that be aware of, depending on where you are geographically, state by state, it's very fragmented. And in certain states, you may be able to only go apply for a new license. And that's a whole different process compared to some states where, like Colorado, you have to go buy an existing license. They're not giving out any more new licenses, so there's moratoriums. And so you've got to really understand kind of your market that you want to operate in and what the landscape is for you to go and apply. And so usually if you're going to go and apply for a license, and that's kind of the approach I'll take today, most of these are a merit-based application process, meaning they're competitive and they're going to be giving out limited licensing. And so it's going to be your job to really educate the state on why you can win this license and you're the most qualified. And so really first and foremost is you've got to understand, you know, your cost to get into this business. What is it going to take to rent a retail space, find that location, to build it out, to make sense for, to meet all of the compliance and regulation from the state's aspect of it, paying close attention to the customer experience, as well as the experience for your staff as they bring in product. And so you got to really put together a pro forma model to really understand all the cost that it's going to take from a capital expenditure to build this thing out. Also understanding from an operation standpoint, how many employees is it going to take? How many days a week are you open? How many hours a day are you open? How much product do you think you're going to sell daily? How much product do you have to sell daily so that you can make at least enough money to keep your doors open? Without putting together these tools like this, you're going to have a hard time really convincing the state to give you a license and showing them that you're not going to waste their time and not get a product to the people who are demanding it. And so really, first and foremost, hire a consultant or hire an accounting firm that understands how to put together these models to really give you that kind of roadmap and direction. And that's really what I would recommend being the first thing you do. That's going to tell you your story. Along with that, in parallel, if you're looking at doing this business, you need to find a location. Most of the application processes you're going to go through are going to require you to have some type of location that is qualified, meaning that it is located in the right zone that the city or the county or the state has demanded that it has to be zoned in. And now you understand the footprint that you're going to be operating on. That footprint of that building will help with that financial model. We'll know the square foot. We'll know the power consumption going into it. It'll really help us understand from a construction standpoint the design and the cost that it will take to build this out. Super important to have that. But also keep in mind that going in the application process and having a location chosen, most people are thinking, oh, I've got to go get a lease and pay on a lease for 6 or 8 months to a year before I know if I even win a license or can get the business open. Well, I want to help encourage you to know that you don't have to do that. There are ways to put down letter of intent so that you can, you know, say, hey, if I do win this license, I will now, you know, engage with the lease for you to move forward on this building so that you don't have to go out of pocket to spend money and pay rent month to month with not knowing if you'll ever get licensed or not. And so just know that that's important that to have that location, but you don't have to go out of pocket. Now that you have that location, the design is super important as well. You've got to hire an architect. You've got to understand building code. You've got to meet the ADA compliance aspects so that the handicapped and folks that are having a hard time getting around upstairs have that ability to get in and out. You have restrooms that meet that compliance. But also, too, as I mentioned before, you want to understand the customer experience. What is it like for them to come into the door? How do they get exposed to all the product? What's the education format for them? All of those things are super important in the design. But so is what I call the back of the house. That's the front of the house where the customer experience is. The back of the house is,
where we're doing all the storage of the product, how does product intake when it comes into the facility, really understanding, you know, that whole picture from front of the house and back of the house, and how do those things flow well together. And everyone has a different design component on how they want to put on their facility, but also keep in mind you still have to keep parameters within what the state is demanding. And all that can fall into your security, you know, square footage of certain vault sizes. There's certain things that they will demand, and you have to follow those. And having an architect will help you ensure that you meet all those expectations. A good architect will read all the rules and regulations from the cannabis side as well, but also following our international building codes and standards. And so next component is, let's say we've got all these tools together. Let's say we've got our financial pro forma model. We know what it's going to cost to do this business. We know we have access to that capital. We found a great location. We've got a great landlord that buys into what we're doing. We've got a good LOI. Our architect did a great job putting together our design on the building. We've got all the tools necessary now to go and apply for the application. And this is the tricky part. Make sure you hire either a consulting firm that has done these applications before, some type of legal firm that has done these things before, ideally legal firms that have done things as far as gambling, alcohol, tobacco, these types of licensing. They are familiar with these state RFPs, request for proposals, and they should be a good resource to help you get through this process. Just ensure that they are specialized in whether it's dispensary, cultivation, extraction, and can give you that standard of expertise to ensure that they can answer all the questions properly during the application process.
Earlier in the program, we talked about whether you get a license from the state or buy one in the secondary market. And you said in Colorado, there are no new licenses. Is it less onerous if you're buying a license from an existing owner, or is it just as onerous as going
to the
state?
It's way less onerous. There's way less onerous. We're not doing a merit-based application process. This is now, you don't have to, only reason you have to qualify is just pass the background check with the state. And so it's a line of least resistance to get in and get that license. So it's pretty, a lot easier, less onerous, and is really a line of least resisting to get operational. It kind of makes all of the merit-based application processes look so daunting to compare to buying an existing one.
If we look at that for just a moment and we say, wait a minute, you believe, and I agree with you, that there are going to be some number, unknown at the moment, but some number of mom and pops who will get swallowed up, or the cost will be so prohibitive they can't stay in business. There may be an opportunity, and maybe this is the wrong word to use, but do you see the possibility of fire sales on licenses in the future?
I'm already looking at them right now. Before you called me today, 15 minutes before you and I got on today, I spoke to a guy out of Massachusetts saying, I will sell 50% of my business for XYZ, and it's a fire sale and a half. We're seeing these all the time right now. But let's just preface. Let me preface here, though, that there are some good little mom and pops out there that are making a 20-30% margin and being successful and doing well in their own right. And so let's just say that they're not all failing, and there is a space for them, kind of like microbreweries. But for the most part, you are right. These folks can't compete, and we're seeing fire sales daily. And this is what I'm actively pursuing right now as a company. So we are vetting these deals constantly.
So when the mom and pops typically own one store, or do they own multiple stores, or both?
Usually one or two at the most.
Okay.
Not more than two or three.
So if you're going to hire somebody like you as a consultant, you can be a consultant on somebody who's thinking about buying an existing dispensary. Is that correct?
That's correct. We've got a great due diligence that we put together to kind of go through all the books, making sure the licensing is all up to date. They're not, they don't have any type of, marks against their license, making sure the books are all in order, ensuring the valuation is right. That's one big thing we're always looking at. The valuation needs to be set right on what the marketplace is doing. We help renegotiate leases if leases are too high compared to what the current market rates are. So we do all those things to help you look at vetting those deals.
There may be a significant opportunity for people who are thinking about getting in the business by looking at purchasing existing dispensary licenses and even the real estate, I assume, or the rent, the lease or whatever. So it seems to me like a great opportunity for our America's Cannabis serial entrepreneur. Ellis, how do people get, we're almost out of time, how do people get a hold of you again?
You can find me at American Cannabis Company. Feel free to find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all under the name Ellis Smith. Please reach out. I'd love to hear from you.
We've had a wonderful opportunity to spend some time with Ellis Smith, and you, hopefully you'll understand why we make him our American Cannabis serial entrepreneur. Ellis, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Dan. Greatly appreciate it.
You bet. So if you missed any part of Ellis's conversation, you need to go back and listen. Go to W420RadioNetwork.com and look for the archive section and listen for Ellis. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on the W420 Radio Network.
Welcome to the conversation. Today, our good friend, who's been with us now several times, Emily Flippin, is going to talk to about her work in selecting marijuana stocks. Welcome to the conversation, Emily.
Thank you again for having me, Dan.
You're welcome. So the last time you were on, you talked about the special offer, which was relatively short, for the Marijuana Masters Program. What other ways do people have with working with you or Motley Fool to get involved in the cannabis space?
Well, there's lots of ways to get involved in cannabis that don't involve subscribing to the Marijuana Masters Program, which is, you know, a cannabis-based portfolio. So if someone's just interested in cannabis, there are lots of safer ways to play the market. The Motley Fool's flagship products, Stock Advisor and Rule Breakers, which are constantly open, and you can go to fool.com to read more about those products. Those companies have, I'm going to put it in quotes, cannabis companies in them. They're companies that are not cannabis producers, not even cannabis picks and shovels companies, but companies that have seen a lot of tailwinds as a result of cannabis. So in my mind, there are ways that you can learn about the industry. There are ways to be involved that don't put as much of your capital at risk if you are a more conservative investor.
Do you follow or are you familiar with many ETFs in this space?
I am, and I'm actually not a big fan of cannabis ETFs. Now, there are lots of investors and lots of subscribers to Marijuana Masters who enjoy dabbling in marijuana ETFs. Perhaps the best known is the MJ ETF, which was one of the first cannabis ETFs. However, these ETFs tend to be market cap-weighted funds, which means that they buy a larger proportion of shares in bigger companies. Now, what this results in is you, if you buy the ETF, being overexposed to some of the largest and thus most overvalued cannabis companies. What I tend to do in my job is I look for smaller, lesser-known cannabis companies that have a competitive edge, and then I choose allocation for the marijuana portfolio based off of that competitive edge. A lot of these ETFs are just going after the big dogs in the industry, and as a result, you'll see that these ETFs are down, you know, 60, 50% over their highs. So there's lots of volatility in ETFs, and over the long term, I think a lot of these ETFs will be fine. But if you're an individual investor and you go out there and you buy some of these ETFs and you see it go down 20 or 30%, you may be confused. You may pull your money out and then automatically lock in those losses simply because you don't know what they're doing. And ultimately what they're doing is usually buying shares of a very overvalued company.
Emily, I've been managing money for almost 50 years, and I refuse to pay a price earnings multiple that has triple digits in it, no matter what the industry is. But what I find about in the cannabis space, and you can help me with this and help our listeners with this, it's really tough to find information about the companies. Many of these companies, which are cash companies, because there's no banking provisions in the law, have difficulty in putting together reliable financial statements. And I'm not saying that they're misleading. I'm just saying that with cash, there's lots of things that you can and can't do in your business. How do you help people figure out what's the best way to begin their own personal research in following these little-known companies?
I think the best way is to understand the regulations and the environment in which the company is operating. A lot of these cannabis companies are listed and based out of Canada, which means they report under IFRS. IRCRS, unlike U.S.-based GAAP, if you're listed on one of the major exchanges, doesn't require an auditor to attest to things like internal controls. Now, that's probably meaningless for the average, you know, retail investor, but it's essentially saying that these auditors don't need to say, hey, look, you know, the numbers they report, auditors just take the numbers and they say, you know, is there anything materially wrong with them? They don't testify to whether or not they are accurate to represent the core underlying business. And so when you look at internal controls, like you mentioned, it's all a cash-based business. The internal controls for most of these cannabis companies are extremely weak. So a lot of times management doesn't even know what numbers to report because so much of this is going on in cash. It requires it. It's a very faulty system that a lot of companies have set up. However, if you look at companies listed on major exchanges here in the U.S., these are not pure-play cannabis companies because you cannot list on the major exchanges if you're a pure-play cannabis company in the U.S. But a lot of these ancillary picks and shovels companies, you know, they have auditors that will attest to their internal controls. Reading the auditor's report is a great place to start to understand, hey, where may there be issues? And also just looking at the financial statements themselves. Granted, it's not going to save you a lot of the time because, like I said, if auditors can't catch it, it's kind of ridiculous to expect you or I to catch it. However, looking at them, reading management's comments, if you see a company, I mean, Aurora Cannabis to me is the most like obvious company to pull out for this, but if you see a company that has a tangible book value per share of 44 cents, that's to say that the vast majority of their assets are intangible assets, you know, they're losing a lot of money, all of this stuff is readily available on the financial statements of Aurora, that should be the immediate red flag to you that something's not right here. And so take the time, understand the regulatory environment, and read over the financial statements. It's kind of the minimum that you need to do before you invest in cannabis.
Emily, there's a lot of people who buy on emotion. They buy because their brother-in-law said they should buy something. They don't really understand what it is they're buying. And when we have a correction like we've seen, and you mentioned perhaps as much as a 60% decline in the value of some of these equities, people lose confidence. They didn't have necessarily confidence going in because they were depending upon somebody else's recommendation who may or may not have known anything, but they put their money in and they see it down 60% and they start to panic and they'll pull it out or they wonder, you know, have I made a serious mistake? 60% decline is more than a bear market in an asset class. Are we, in your opinion, do you think we're at a buying entry point, or do we have some more downside?
I mean, personally, I've been buying over the past year. I give very little thought to the short-term market moves that other investors may do. If you look at studies, and you'll read studies every day about why individual investors underperform even just index funds, and every time it comes back to investor psychology, people buy and sell too often. They're bad at determining when's the right buying point and when's the right selling point, and they underperform as a result. So in my opinion, you have two options as an investor. Either you take somebody else's advice and you forget about it and you don't touch it, you hold it for 5, 7, 10 years, and then you come back to it, and more likely than not, you've made money on that investment. You might have lost 60% at some point. Amazon stock, for instance, lost upwards of 60, 70% of its value in early 2000. But as long as you continue to hold, you'd be fine. Now, I'm not saying cannabis stocks are Amazon, but I am saying this is the trend that you'll see with investors. The best investors tend to be people who do not look at their portfolio every day. The flip side of that is, I know the majority of people who do go out of their way to buy and sell stocks probably enjoy looking at their portfolio every day. In that case, what I say to you is develop a strong investing thesis. If your friend tells you to buy Aurora Cannabis, which please don't buy Aurora Cannabis, but if somebody tells you to buy that stock, lay out why you're buying it, lay out where you think it's going to go, and what would change your mind. And then if Aurora Cannabis is down 60%, come back to those points and ask yourself, has my answer to any of these things changed? Has there been any material change in my thesis for buying the company? If not, let it ride. And so my opinion to that is to say, I'm not a trader. I don't trade. I mean, the last stock I sold, I think, gosh, it must have been a year and a half ago. I sold Best Buy, and it was a mistake. And so individual investors are terrible at selling stocks. So Don't sell. You're not a trader. You're an investor. You're buying a piece of a business for the long term. Whether or not we're at a bottom in the market right now, it's anyone's guess. But I've been buying cannabis for the past year. I expect I'll be continuing to buy cannabis in 2020, likely 2021, likely 2022. And I would expect over time these investments, maybe not Aurora, but these investments will start to pay off.
We're speaking with Emily Flippin from Motley Fool. And by the way, how do people get a hold of you, Emily?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is Flippin_Emily.
Thank you. So you talk about being long-term investors, and I understand that. We talked about that a lot of people use emotion in selling, and I happened to be in Switzerland many years ago working with the Swiss bankers in creating a new investment, and I asked him what he thought the difference was between American investors and Swiss investors, and he said Swiss investors don't make investment decisions based on emotions. Americans are very emotional about their investments. And I never forgot that, and I've used that in all my life in managing money, is when you're panicked, when you're afraid, when you're scared, it's the wrong time to make an investment decision, buy or sell. We have the couple of things that are affecting this industry that if they were to change, I believe, and I'd be interested in your position, would dramatically change the prospects. If we got decriminalization of marijuana and we had an opportunity to be able to manufacture and ship across state borders, wouldn't that change the dynamics of this business dramatically?
There's probably 1,000 things that could change, especially here in the U.S., that could dramatically improve or hurt the prospects of cannabis-based companies. These changes seem easy, and I'm a big reporter of believing that they're coming sooner rather than later. Federal legalization to me feels like a win, not an if. However, it's important to realize that these are longer processes than people may give them credit for. 2019, part of the reason why it was such a bad year for cannabis was because in the U.S., the markets didn't live up to their potential. Not only are we seeing California, obviously, with their tax increases, hurting the legal market, but New York, New Jersey, they failed to pass any sort of legalization bill. And these are liberal states. These are states that it was kind of considered a lock for them to pass these bills. And so far, Illinois is the only state here in the U.S. that has passed legalization through the legislature. And I believe that moving forward, we're going to see states have to use the legislature to pass these sorts of bills. And that's a long, hard, complicated process. It requires politicians and state officials to agree on the intricate details of legalization. In New York and New Jersey, there is very little disagreement about whether or not they wanted pot to be decriminalized, they wanted pot to be legalized on a state level. It was, how do we implement this? And the fact that they weren't able to agree on how to implement it means that these changes like cross-border shipping and even just state legalization are going to be challenging. Now, like I said, I don't want to paint doom and gloom for the cannabis industry because it does feel like a domino effect. And I think as we see states, Illinois laid out a great blueprint for other states to follow. So as we see states start to legalize, hopefully it will make it easier for other states too. But it is a long process. And going into an election year, people's minds are all over the place. So I think right now there are 9 states that are likely to have some sort of cannabis legalization or decriminalization on their November 2020 ballots. And we'll see then just how easy it is or hard it is for them to pass these legalization efforts.
Terrific. We've been speaking to Emily Flippin from the Motley Fool organization, and she is a co-manager of Marijuana Masters. Thank you for joining us today, Emily. And one more time, where can they find information about you and what your thoughts are at the moment about marijuana investors?
I'm on Twitter, so you can find me at Flippin_Emily on Twitter. I do love to talk about companies, so feel free to shoot me a tweet.
Thank you. We've been speaking to Emily Flippin, and if you didn't hear all of this interview, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com, and you can download this show and other shows that Emily's been on and other guests for free. This is Dan Perkins. Thank you for joining the conversation.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.